Up next, we have our book reading program, Ohomoni Iyotaka, read by Gail Hubling.
The Long Knives Are Crying, a novel by Joseph M. Marshall III. Chapter 36. A Thin Veil of Dust. Black Shield stood outside his lodge as dawn chased away the dark hues of night. A soft morning breeze caressed the leaves of the giant cottonwoods that stood all around. He offered tobacco to the sky, the earth, the four directions, and then to the Great Spirit. Finishing his prayer, he began his morning stretching ritual, starting with his legs. Like the great mountain lion, he stretched his legs behind him one at a time. Then he bent over slowly, working his back muscles. Upright again, he twisted deliberately from side to side. After that, he rotated his head, loosening the neck muscles. He finished with his arms, reaching for unseen points until his muscles began to protest, and then he rotated them slowly. Black Shield had performed the stretching ritual nearly every morning for the past 20 years, beginning in the days when he was no longer an active warrior. Although he was one of a few men his age who could still swing up on a horse, he was finding it more difficult as the years went by. But he was not yet ready to use a mounting step, a simple short hardwood stilt. Most elderly people had some kind of morning ritual, whether to stretch or meditate or pray. Black Shield meditated as he stretched. This morning he was contemplating the future. He didn't like what he had been hearing since the battle along the Rosebud 8 days ago. Many of those who had broken away from the Spotted Tail or Red Cloud agencies were talking of going back, worried that the Long Knives would exact retribution. Sitting Bull had invited the old men leaders to a meeting today around noon. Black Shield knew the Hunkpapa medicine man was worried that many wanted to leave, and the only way to prevent them from doing so was to talk them out of it. Black Shield turned at the slight rustling noise and saw his wife setting up his willow chair to the right of the doorway, next to the willow tripod. He retrieved his pipe bag from the tripod and took a seat. It was on his mind to have a smoke. More than once, a good smoke had relaxed his mind and enabled him to think. And there was much to think about. All around, the village was awakening. Black Shield heard the sound of hand axes cutting firewood and smelled smoke from cooking fires already started. The early part of morning was one of the most peaceful periods of the day, before the busyness took over. He leaned back and opened the pipe bag. Later, he intended to have a talk with Grey Bull. Farther south, Sitting Bull emerged from a lodge, pipe bag in hand and a rolled-up bundle under his arm. Through most of the night, he had been treating a very ill elderly woman. Before that, he had crossed the river and climbed to the top of a ridge to spend the evening praying. So he was emotionally and physically exhausted. The old woman was sleeping now, and he wanted to go home and have a good, strong cup of coffee to revive him. There was much to do today. As he passed between lodges, two teenage boys were about to cross his path, but paused when they recognized him. "It is good to see you, Grandfather," one of them said shyly. "You are awake early," the medicine man replied. "We were watching the horses last night," the older of the two said. "We are going home to sleep." "Yes, yes, I remember those days. Watching horses, listening to the nighthawks, and chasing away mosquitoes." The boy smiled. "Our mother is Stands on the Hill. Our father is Little Bird," the older one told him. "Yes," Sitting Bull replied. "I know them. Tell me your names." "I am Ashes," the older boy said. "This is my brother, Two Horns." "It is good to know you, grandsons. Now you need sleep. I need coffee." Sitting Bull looked around at the brightening sky. "It will be hot today, I think. Or maybe it is something else I feel in my bones." For a moment, the boy stood and watched the Hunkpapa medicine man trudging away, limping slightly. As soon as dawn came and the land grew bright, the night guards around the herd were relieved. Fewer guards were needed during the day. Already they were letting the horse spread out across the lush river bottom, though they would keep watchful eyes to the west and north. In the northern half of the village, a lodge stood beneath an especially tall cottonwood tree. Because of the camp's location in the long and wide cottonwood grove, many lodges were pitched next to trees to take advantage of the shade they provided. This morning, a young man lay beneath his elk robe and looked up through the smoke hole and saw leaves wavering in the breeze. His father was already outside. Black Wolf heard him blowing on the kindling to start the cooking fire. Near the door, his mother was gathering food containers to take outside. "Are you awake?" she asked. "I am," he replied. "I thought I would take a walk and see to our horses." A worried frown creased her forehead. "Your side was still bleeding a little yesterday," she reminded him. Black Wolf smiled. "But not too much, and it was because I rode." "Have something to eat first," she asserted. "Rest and good food will help you heal faster." He had been wounded at the battle where the woman saved her brother. A battle had torn through his side, and the pain was bothersome on the ride home. It was likely the loss of blood that caused him to faint and fall from his horse, much to his embarrassment. But Crazy Horse had been quick to help him. As a matter of fact, he had stopped by last evening. As smoothly as he could manage, in spite of the dull ache, Black Wolf sat up, mainly to indicate to his mother that he was well. "I will make some tea and cook soup," she said, ducking out through the door. After a moment, he arose slowly and followed her. As he went out into the cool, down air, his eyes were immediately drawn to the little tripod to the right of the door. His weapons had already been placed there. His mother had done that. For some reason, his gaze moved over the breech-loading rifle in its case and the unstrung bow in its case. But what caught and held his attention was the quiver bristling with war arrows. In the Hunkpapa camp to the south, a woman hung a kettle filled with water from the iron tripod standing over the fire. She turned in time to see Sitting Bull, with a bundle under one arm, enter his lodge. She saw him leave the evening before around dusk. Her husband, Gaul, told her the medicine man was going across the river to pray. High ridges on the east side of the river cast long shadows and hid the large encampment. From atop those ridges, the lodges were easily seen, but from the floor of the floodplain, only a few were visible, the rest hidden by the cottonwood trees and thickets. Lazy breezes wandered through, and more people began to emerge and move about. Near the council lodge, the remains of a large fire were still smoldering. One of the warrior societies had put on a victory celebration, and the dancing had gone on most of the night. Cloud had been invited and had attended, but he did not stay long. He wanted to work with a yearling colt that was showing promise as a runner. From the silence in the lodge, except for songs, even breathing, he knew Sweetwater Woman was already outside. Someone was chopping wood. When he stepped outside, he smelled the coffee first and then the meat roasting over the flames. It had been a while since they had had coffee. "Sit," Sweetwater Woman told him. "My mother traded for coffee and gave us some." He could see bits of the pulverized black seeds on her pounding stone, where she had ground them down. It was a bitter brew, a favorite among the people, but hard to obtain. After the water in the blackened pot had boiled, she had simply added the black powder. "I saw your cousin walking around by himself yesterday," she mentioned as she finished cutting strips of fresh elk meat, "after we moved. It is good to see that his wound is healing." Cloud smiled as he took a seat. "My sister-in-law is probably the happiest about that," he said. "I think he is making her crazy." "Yes," she replied, concentrating on her task. "It is not easy to keep a home in order when a man is underfoot. Even a wounded man?" Sweetwater Woman looked up for a moment, her eyes twinkling over a smile. "Especially a wounded man. They can be more needful than a small child and sometimes behave like one." Cloud chuckled softly. "He who protects the home gets restless when he is there too long." "It is one of the strange things in life," Sweetwater Woman said. A dove suddenly cooed somewhere in the branches above them. For a moment, its soft, mournful call silenced every other sound. Sweetwater Woman paused and glanced toward her husband. "For some reason," she said gently, "that makes me feel sad." Something in her tone seemed like a warning. Cloud glanced to the side at the willow tripod, where his weapons were already hanging. Overhead, the dove cooed again. Its voice was not loud, but somehow it evoked a sense of deep melancholy, something akin to grief. After a moment, Cloud shook his head and looked toward his wife. "It is their purpose to remind us there is sadness in the world," he said. "Perhaps it is nothing more than that." Sweetwater Woman was motionless, staring into the flames of the cooking fire. "Perhaps," she allowed, "but right now it annoys me." Soft gurgles from the blackened pot interrupted the moment, and both of them looked at the coffee boiling over, out of the spout. Sweetwater Woman quickly grabbed a piece of hide, folded it over the handle, and removed the pot. "My mother wants to move her lodge," she commented as she tried to move her thoughts to the day ahead. "I think she put it over an old creek bed, and there is a hole in the floor. I will help her." "Good," Cloud replied, and watched as she poured coffee into a metal cup. He waited to hear the dove again, but it was silent. I want to work with that yearling colt, the buckskin. He is fast, but he also has a quiet way about him. He might be a good horse for song. Sweetwater woman nodded and sent a quick glance up into the tree branches. Rising above the ridges across the river, the sun illuminated the cottonwood groves and thickets along the greasy grass in less than a heartbeat. The encampment of 1,000 lodges or more instantly felt the warmth of its life-giving rays. Throughout the village's length and breadth, elderly men and women lifted their gray heads and turned deeply seen faces to the east to pay homage to the light, acknowledging that another day had been added to their lives. Low shelters stood among the shrubs and thickets near the river's edge where it meandered east of the encampment. Here, men, mostly young and unattached, but some older and without their families, made their camps. Most of the shelters were simple triangular or dome frames covered with blankets or robes to keep the occupants dry if there was rain, and to act as enough of a windbreak to take the bite out of a chilly breeze. At one such shelter, directly east of the Sichongo camp, two young men were already sitting at their fire. Horntail was in the last phase of making arrows, attaching iron points to 8 willow shafts onto which he had already tied and glued feathers. His cousin Bear counted again the number of round lead balls he had for his old muzzle-loading rifle. They had arrived the day before, following the wide trail from the site on Ash Creek. It had taken them 20 days to get that far, traveling from the White Earth River Valley west of the Great Muddy River on the northern fringes of Sichongo Lakota Territory. Their families and a few others had chosen to take their chances and live apart from the agencies. The two young men, not yet 20, had been impatient to join the gathering since the winter, when they had first learned of Sitting Bull's message. But because of their meager circumstances, there were no horses to spare. A month ago, Horntail's father had found 2 wagon horses wandering along a creek and decided to give his son and nephew his only riding horse, a slow but steady gelding. Over the journey, they alternated, using it as a pack horse and a riding horse. Their weaponry had consisted of Horntail's 2 bows and nearly 40 arrows, and Bear's old muzzle loader and 12 balls. Along the way, Horntail had cut enough willow stalks to make 20 more shafts. Yet they were less concerned about being poorly armed and more concerned about missing the excitement. At the victory celebration last night, they both listened to story after story about the battle where the woman saved her brother. "How long do you think we should stay?" Bear asked, already acquiescing to the end of their adventure. "We need to hunt," Horntail replied, "to make enough meat to last through the winter. Our fathers want us to hunt with the bow." "Yes, I know," Bear replied. "A bow is quieter and we can make as many arrows as we need, but shot and powder are hard to get." "We have to hunt along the Great Muddy this fall," Horntail said. "The big gullies and breaks there have more deer and elk. I have heard that the people have been here for over a month, but no one is certain how much longer they will stay." Bear sighed as he moved a small kettle over the flames. "I wish we could have been here several days ago," he said. Horntail looked up from wrapping sinew around the tip of the shaft, binding it to the point. "We are here now," he stated patiently. "We have missed the battle, but we can learn what the old men are thinking, what they want our people to do. That is what our fathers wanted to know." "Do you think your father will join City Bull and Crazy Horse?" "It is what he said and what your father said, too. They both think we will be stronger if we stay together. They hate the agencies, but they also know it is a risk to live the way we do, always on the lookout for whites and long knives. If they knew the people would band together, they would join." Bear looked at his cousin. "Yes, I think you are right." He watched Horntail's skillful fingers. "Why are you so good at making bows and arrows?" he asked. Horntail shrugged. "My grandfather taught me. If you could make guns, that would be better." Far to the east, in the bottom of a deep gully, several men stood quietly with their horses, their weapons drawn and ready, listening for the sound of galloping horses. "I saw only one rider," Barrow whispered. "I found some things, a bag and a container made of wood with hard bread in it. The rider was a long knife. I left because it was hard to know if there were others behind him." "What about tracks?" someone asked. "Horses with iron on their feet, the way whites do," Barrow replied, "going east." "Crazy Horse needs to know, Two Bulls," a tall, gangly young man said. "I will go," Barrow volunteered. "Go north and cross Ash Creek and then circle to the east," Two Bulls advised. "If these are long knives, they will stay in the low areas, out of sight." At a nod from Two Bulls, a lithe teenager climbed to the lip of the gully and slipped in between two boulders and scrutinized the wider gully that stretched east and west. "Nothing," he whispered fiercely. I see nothing, no riders. Good, Tubal said. He turned to Bearrobe. Stay in the low areas until you are north of Ash Creek. We will wait and then follow the tracks you saw and see who or what made them. At mid-morning, Rain in the Face finished his walk around the Hunkwapa village circle. A brisk walk helped to loosen the stiffness in his leg, a consequence of an old wound that bothered him more and more these days. The long ride to Rosebud Creek and back, not to mention the fighting, had aggravated the injury. He was glad for the warm days of summer. They helped his stiff hip and knee joints. Already it was evident the day would be hot and he would not complain. A few girls and young women who were gathering twigs and firewood in the brush smiled and waved as he passed. Their long braids glistened as sunlight struck them. The Hunkpapa warrior glimpsed the high ridges just east of the river between the trees as he stopped south of his own lodge. A ride across the river and up to the ridges would be in order, he thought, but first he wanted to talk with Gaul. On the opposite end of the encampment north of the Cheyenne lodges, several women were walking leisurely, chatting as they went. I heard a branch crack in the night, Good Plume said, a big branch just above the lodge. I saw it this morning. If it falls, anyway, I will move today. Good Plume was a widow, as were her three companions, Little Creek, White Crane, and High Voice. They had been friends for many years, drawn even closer now by their common status. Good Plume had lost her husband at the Battle of the Hundred in the Hand. High Voice's husband had been killed by Crow horse raiders when he pursued them alone. White Crane's husband had gone hunting west of the Shining Mountains and never returned. For years now, they had pitched their lodges next to one another and helped each other with raising children and other responsibilities that had grown heavier because of their losses. Where Good Plume went, the others followed, and so they would move their lodges too. Then we should move your lodge first, White Crane decided. Good Plume pointed northwest of the Cheyenne lodges to an area between two thickets. That looks like a good place, she said. They stood for a moment planning. Good Plume noticed that High Voice had been unusually quiet. Sister, she said, is there something on your mind? High Voice nodded. What do you think will happen after the summer? She wondered. Hard to say, Good Plume replied. Why do you ask? My cousin came from the agency, High Voice said, but she and her husband plan on going back. She thinks I should go with them. The other three women exchanged surprised, troubled glances. Why would you do that? Little Creek asked timidly. It would be easier on the children, my cousin said. At the agency, we would be safer from Long Knives attacking us the way they do out here, High Voice said. But our men stopped the Long Knives who tried to attack us, Good Plume protested. Yes, this time, but what about the next time? What if they send more Long Knives and we have men? What then? High Voice demanded, an edge of distress in her usually soft voice. None of us have husbands to protect us and our children, and I do not think I could stand it if one of my children was killed. Good Plume reached out and took her distraught friend's hand. My husband died to keep his family free, away from the clutches of the whites, she said. Every night I go to bed with a memory, but for me it cannot be any other way because here I am free to do what is best for my children. Sister, you cannot leave us, Little Creek pleaded. We have taken care of one another, and we always will, no matter what happens. High Voice looked around at the circle of worried faces. Yes, yes, you are right, she admitted. White Crane smiled and pointed toward the horse herd, almost numberless, grazing the plush bottomland. Look at them. That is how strong we are. Who will dare give us trouble here? North of Ash Creek, past the point where the Middle Fork joined the North Fork, Two Bulls and his companion saw the smoke from the area near where the encampment had stood only 3 days before. Someone had started a fire, and they suspected it had something to do with the thin dust cloud hanging over the Middle Fork. Loping their horses up a gully, they topped the narrow opening onto the valley and saw a lone rider on a horse on an opposite hill. Below him was a column of Long Knives. Get back over the hill, Two Bulls said. If they follow us, we will lead them away. If they do not, we need to see where they are going. They turned and Two Bulls led them along the slope, heading northwest in full view of the column on the other side of the valley. But no one was chasing them. They finally crossed over a ridge and down onto the north slope. Two Bulls signaled a halt. No one is following, someone said. Then we stay here and watch them, Two Bulls decided. Bear Rope should be getting close to the encampment if he's not there already. Circling back and remaining behind intervening ridges, the warriors gained a brushy ridge and stopped. Climbing to the crest, they saw the column in the distance, continuing west along the creek. Beneath the shade of the cottonwoods, as they finished staking a fresh elk hide, hair down to the ground. Beneath the shade of the cottonwoods, as they finished staking a fresh elk hide, hair down to the ground, black shawl and looks back woman heard the soft footfalls of a man and a horse. Sunbeams were streaming nearly straight down through the tree branches. It was the middle of the day. Crazy Horse returned to the lodge, leading one of his favorite horses, a fast sorrel gelding. Black Shawl knew what her husband was planning. "I think she will like that horse," she told him. Looks Back Woman looked at her puzzled. "My husband has given that horse to the Cheyenne woman, Buffalo Calf Road," Black Shawl explained. The older woman nodded. "And this," Crazy Horse said, pulling a large eagle feather out of a painted case hanging from the willow tripod. "I will not be gone long," he added, then left. "He always says that," Black Shawl said, smiling patiently as she watched her husband leading the horse away. "I probably will not see him until sundown." Looks Back Woman stood. "I will go get water from the river so we can soak the hide before we rub in the brains," she said. "Wait and rest until I get back." At the river, Looks Back Woman met Sweetwater Woman and Song, who were busy filling three water bladders. A man on horseback passed behind them, leading a pack horse laden with his belongings. Bird stopped at the bank and dismounted to water his horses. A young man sitting somewhat disconsolately at his brush shelter looked up from his fire and recognized the man with the horses as one of those who had recently come from the Spotted Tail Agency, then stared at the loaded pack horse. "Are you leaving?" Little Feather asked. Bird nodded. She was a widower with no children, and he had grown to like the easy life at the agency. "I hope they do not punish you for leaving," Little Feather cautioned. Bird shrugged as he watched his horses drink. He had never liked this young man, the one everyone called Bug. He was a lackey for the one called White Hat Clark. What he was doing here was a mystery to him. "I do not think so. They will punish those who stay away," he retorted. "I am staying," Little Feather replied haughtily. "I like it here." Bird chuckled under his breath but said no more. Mounting his bay riding horse, he grabbed the lead rope to the pack horse and began crossing the river. Little Feather watched the man pick away across the strong current. Behind his brush shelter, the village was busy with all the things of living. Horses were led to water between the lodges, passing those already picketed next to lodge doors. Bands of children roved. Young boys dashed about like flocks of birds. Women were busy with endless chores of seeing to their families. All in all, there was constant motion beneath the whispering leaves of the cottonwood trees, standing guard with their thick branches spread protectively like the wings of the mystic thunderbird. From the front of the council lodge, High Eagle and Worm watched the man crossing the river as well. They knew that some people were planning on leaving. "I think that is not the last of it," High Eagle said, pointing toward the rider leading a pack horse across the water. Worm nodded. "I think you are right." Many hills to the east, the young man knelt on one knee and gazed at the swelling of his horse's front left ankle. A dirt ledge had crumbled beneath them on a downhill slope and they had tumbled. Bear Robe dusted himself off. He reached over and retrieved his rifle from the grass, checked himself over and adjusted his belt and clothing. He sighed dejectedly and looked around. He had a long way to go and his horse was hurt. In an instant, he decided what to do. Removing the neck rope and the long rein, he coiled them and draped them over his shoulder. With an experienced eye, he watched for signs of other injuries as he pushed the gray sideways. The ankle seemed to be the only one, but the gelding favored it noticeably. Bear Robe knew he was lucky that he had not suffered any injury himself. "I have to leave you here, but I will come back for you," he said. "You can eat all you want. There is water nearby. I know you will find it." Bear Robe turned away, reluctantly, looking back. The gray watched him, its ears perked forward, apparently puzzled by the turn of events. At the bottom of the slope, Bear Robe got his bearings, picked out a butte in the distant greening landscape and broke into an easy trot. He knew the rifle would get heavy after a while. Bird climbed the ridge at an angle to avoid having to go straight up the slope, some of which were steep. He was in no particular hurry. The weather was good, and once over the ridges, the horses would settle into a fast walk. At the top, he paused to look back over his shoulder. He had never seen an encampment with so many people, or one as long. Countless circles of lodge poles poked up through the openings in the tall trees, reminding him of the antlers of a herd of elk he had seen once near the Shell River. For a moment he wondered if he was doing the right thing by going back to the agency. There was nothing keeping him here, he decided. He had no one. He clucked to the bay he rode and tugged on the lead rope of the pack horse. In a way, he was looking forward to the long journey. Bird didn't immediately see the dust cloud to the south. It was barely noticeable, a low, thin veil hanging over a dark line of trees. But after a moment, he realized that a dust cloud might mean something. He reined his horses to a halt. It was a ways off, but Bird could tell that whatever was making the dust was at the junction where Ash Creek flowed into the Greasy Grass River, and the dust was moving. In near disbelief, he saw a long line of dark figures, people on horses, crossing the river. The front of the line gained the west bank of the Greasy Grass and turned north. Long knives! Momentarily stunned, Bird watched the line stretched out as more men continued crossing. Shaking his head, he jerked the rein of his horse and turned him, kicking him savagely. The bay broke into a lope, but the pack horse was reluctant, and Bird realized he had to leave it behind, so he let go of the lead rope. At a gallop, he retraced the trail down the slope that he had ridden up leisurely, sliding to a stop on a bank high above the water. From there, he could still see the long knives in the distance on the green floodplain. He was across from the southern end of the village. Throwing caution aside, he forced the bay down the bank and hit the water with a splash, sending white spray in all directions. With powerful lunges, the horse surged across the current and scrambled up the bank. "Long knives!" Bird yelled. "Long knives are coming from the south!" And that concludes chapter 36.
This program is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to Ohomani Iotaka on KDKO 89.5 FM.